to eat or not to eat? Actually, that's kind of a little funny because we're having the potluck later, but anyway, that's it. Recently at Stratford, at the Stratford Festival, they've been showing or having a play called Spamalot. And someone here had seen it. Who was it? I've seen it, but not this recent one. Was it you? Janet? Did you go? It was you? Spamalot. Anyway, it's based on the irreverent comedy of Monty Python, and particularly their wonderful film called The Holy Grail. There's a picture of it. It's a send-up, of course, of King Arthur's tales, and there's a scene, there's a part of it there, where one of the knights, I love their name, Sir Bedivere, who is confronted by a group of villagers, and it seems that these villagers have grabbed one of the local women and claim that she is a witch. It's obvious that her long crooked nose is fake and has been tied on, and she's dressed up to look like a witch. Sir Bedivere questions the evidence, and the people confess that they've made it all up, but they still want to burn the woman as a witch. You know, we may not judge people today as being witches anymore, but you know what? We still judge people for everything else under the sun. We judge people by their clothing, by their jobs, by their friends. We judge people by the kind of car they drive, by the music they listen to. We judge them by their hairstyle, their family, and also where they live. We love jumping to conclusions, and sometimes that's all the exercise any of us ever get. That's what normal people do, right? Don't forget, as I stressed last week, we're not normal people. We're abnormal people. That's right. I've said it. We are abnormal. We have given our lives to Christ, and through Christ, we are called to live to a different standard than the world. God calls on us to love each other and to treat each other the same no matter what. We are called to no longer live in the judgment house where the doors are locked and bolted, where there's no handle from the outside to get in. And you can only get in if someone lets you in. Instead, through Christ, we are called to live in the grace and the mercy house, where the door is always open and a welcoming committee is there to greet you. And if there is no welcoming committee there to greet you, it's not because you're not welcome, it's because they're gone out into the world to find others who need a place to live. All of this makes Paul's framing of Romans 14 particularly helpful. In great wisdom, he frames this passage not in terms of finding out who is strong and who is weak to compare and to cancel each other, but in terms of seeking to discover who has diverse thoughts and backgrounds and experiences to care, to support, and to mutually edify. Paul is encouraging readers to discover and then to honor those differences among them, among the faithful. He tells them to practice compassion and even deference to those with radically different conceptions of what holiness and discipleship look like. As we look at the letter to Romans, we see how Paul talks about judging others and also about which house we should live in. Paul is really in this chapter saying in essence, where do you live? In which house do you reside? Are you living in the house of judgment or are you living in the house of mercy and grace? like many of Paul's subjects, it's a subject, well, frankly, most of us don't want to talk about or hear about. Paul is point blank in talking about standing in judgment of other people. He's blunt about it. You can almost hear in his writing the disbelief, the sadness, the spiritual amazement in his voice as he writes, "Who are you to pass judgment on the servants of another?" Why would he write something like that? Well, we have to remember that the early church was made up really of two very distinct groups of people, the Jews and the Gentiles. The Jewish people, of course, were those who had been raised with very strict dietary rules, especially concerning meat that had been offered to pagan idols. In Rome, most of the butcher shops in the city were run by the temples, by the pagan temples. People would come and they would offer an animal sacrifice to their idol, to their god, and the meat was then sold to the public from a butcher shop attached to the temple. And the money went to where? Well, to the temple coffers, right? Now, for a practicing Jewish person, eating that meat was a giant no-no. It was tantamount, they thought, to actually worshiping the idol yourself. They also lived by a strict and hard and fast rule about the Sabbath, didn't they? Now, the Sabbath in their mind was the seventh day, or Saturday, which was a day of rest. Now, the Gentiles, who were raised without any knowledge whatsoever about dietary laws, and most of them initially had really no concept of what a Sabbath was all about. But when they accepted Jesus Christ, they began to worship together, not on Saturday, but on the first day of the week, Sunday. Sunday was the day which coincided with Christ's resurrection, and so they gathered on that day to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. It was to them like every Sunday was kind of like a miniature Easter. So in the early church, you had a group of well-meaning, knowledgeable, experienced old-timers who'd had a religious awakening in Jesus. And they were stirring up the newcomers, the new baby Christians who were still growing in their faith, just not in their faith, but in the knowledge of their faith. They didn't understand why things for their Jewish brethren were done a certain way. Now, we got to be careful here. The old timers who have been around a bit, they weren't being mean-spirited. They were not. They just simply thought they were right. That's the way we've always done it. This controversy about eating meat from idols and which day was the Sabbath was actually getting out of hand in the early church. It was a real problem. It was an issue that nearly tore every congregation apart. So Paul writes this portion of the letter to address this particular issue. Now, I can guess, I think, what you're thinking about right now. So what? What difference does this make to me today? Well, not much really, at least in the answer to the question of meat being sacrificed to idols. I can't remember the last time I went to a pagan table or temple to buy steaks. I just can't remember. The Sabbath question really has been answered for over the years, mostly by practice and tradition, but also due to what Paul writes here. But Paul's clear that this is not about a day to worship or the food you eat. The point is, it's about honoring God. This is what he writes. Some judge one day better than another, while others judge all days to be alike. Let all be fully convinced in their own minds. Those who observe the day, observe it in honor of the Lord. Also those who eat in honor of the Lord, since they give thanks to God. While those who abstain in honor of the Lord and give thanks to God. Paul is telling us basically, quit fighting about the inconsequential things of life. Our activity and our attitude about everything is to be directed to honoring God. Unfortunately, as we all painfully know, we still end up passing judgment on others all the time. Even in the church, right? I came across a story about a pastor in Virginia who was confronted by a man, an angry man, after church one day. "Preacher," the man said, "I have two complaints about you. First, when I was chairman of the trustees, you tried to tell me how to do my job. You should just let the church leaders do their job the way they want. What's the second complaint?" "Well," said the man, "I don't like the hymns the choir director picks. I wish you'd tell her to pick more of the old ones." Do you get the hypocrisy there? The man was not aware that he was giving a mixed message. He wanted the pastor to refrain from telling leaders how to do their jobs, but he wanted the pastor to tell the choir director how to do her job. People are amazing, aren't they? Paul says we should be careful about how we judge one another because each of us is accountable to God. We will all, that is you and I and everyone else, will stand before the judgment seat of God. And Paul only reiterates what Jesus said and reminds us of the basic tenets of our faith. Judge not lest you be judged. That's not just a catchy phrase, folks. It's not something you put on your t-shirt or a bumper sticker. It's supposed to be a way of life. It's supposed to be a mark of who we are. It's supposed to be one of the signs that we are different from the world, that we're abnormal. Once we accepted Jesus, we were evicted or moved out of the judgment house. And we were challenged to move into the grace and mercy house. Because living in the grace and mercy house proves we live to God and not to ourselves. It's only in the grace and the mercy house that we can live to the Lord. You see, it's only through grace and mercy, through the grace and mercy of God that we were able to leave that judgment house. But we can't do it on our own, can we? We must be set free by Jesus. There's a movie, unfortunately I haven't seen it, but it sounds really interesting. It's a movie called Coach Carter. Maybe some of you have seen it, starring Samuel L. Jackson. It's actually based on a true story of a basketball coach who locked his players out of the gym until they focused on their schoolwork and got their grades up. But in the process, he taught them how to play, how to succeed, how to be champions on the court and in life. And there's one scene where, after quitting the team, a young man by the name of Timo Cruz wants to come back and join the team. But the price to rejoin the team seems impossible to pay. Coach Carter requires him, listen to this, to do 2,500 push-ups, 1,000 suicide sprints within a week. Well, Cruz is determined, so he starts. He, right then and there, he hits the deck and starts his push-ups and other things. The week is over, and Coach Carter comes to Cruz to give him an assessment of his work. And Carter tells him, "I'm impressed with what you've done, but you came up short. You owe me 80 suicides and 500 push-ups. Please leave my gym." And Cruz is crushed. He'd worked very hard every day to try and complete what was really an impossible task, but he failed. Coach Carter turns to the team and says that he'll see them tomorrow. And as the coach turns to leave the gym, one of the players says, I'll do push-ups for him. You said we're a team. When one person struggles, we all struggle. One person triumphs, we all triumph, right? And so he goes to the floor with Cruz and he begins to do push-ups. A moment later, another teammate says, I'll do some. I'll run suicides too. And then one by one, every player but one has begun to do push-ups or run for Cruz. And even though he's weary beyond belief, Cruz himself continues to participate with his teammates. And finally, the last player chooses to join as well, saying, I'll do some. While Carter is encouraged by their attitude, he doesn't let them off the hook. He tells his assistant coach to keep counting. Call me when it's done. But as he leaves, you can see that he's proud of those boys. And you know that they finally get what it means to be a team. The scene teaches us a couple of things. One, like Timo Cruz, the task of standing accountable and blameless before God's impossible. There's no way any one of us can be perfect and not be full of sin in a fallen world. We can give it our best shot, but we're always going to come up short. And we are going to come up alone too, aren't we? But the good news is that we don't have to do it alone. Christ Jesus steps into the scene and says, I'll take the burden of that person's sin. I'll take her burden. I'll take his burden. When they triumph, we all triumph. Or as the Apostle Paul wrote, we do not live to ourselves and we do not die to ourselves. If we live, we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. For to this end, Christ died and lived again, so that he might be Lord of both the dead and the living. We need Christ. But the second thing that we need is we need each other. Not only can we not bring about our own salvation, we cannot live in the house of grace and mercy alone. One of the keys for living in the grace and mercy house is to constantly show grace and mercy to each other. That's how we live to the Lord, Paul said. You know, an interesting little story. There was a minister who was visiting one of his parishioners. And as they were talking, the conversation began to lag a little bit. The lady of the house wanted to pick up the conversation, so she pointed out her window to her neighbor's backyard where the wash was hanging on the line. She said, "See that lady next door and the wash she hangs out? See how dirty it is? She never hangs out a clean wash." Well, the pastor felt somewhat uncomfortable and tried to change the subject, and he quickly brought the visit to a close. As he was departing from the house, the lady of the house walked out to the front porch with him. And again, the wash next door was clearly visible to both people. And they both realized that this wash was sparkling white and just as white as any wash could be. And the truth began to dawn on them that it wasn't the neighbor's wash that was dirty. Rather, it was the window through which they had viewed that wash. How clean are your windows? Where do you live? Which house do you live in? The judgment house or the grace and mercy house? Even when we think we are more enlightened than our brother or sister, we can still cause a lot of damage to people. The theme of being cautious with our knowledge and our freedom that we think it gives us arises again even more clearly from Paul in 1 Corinthians 8. This is what Paul says. Now, when it comes to meat offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs you up, but love builds you up. If anyone thinks they know something, they don't yet know in the way they ought to know. The problem is not everybody has this knowledge. Some have been accustomed up to now to eating idol food with the assumption that it really does belong to an idol. This has left them with a weak conscience, and now that conscience will be polluted. But the food we eat won't recommend us to God. We won't be any worse off if we don't eat. We won't be any better off if we do. But if you take care in case this official right of yours becomes a danger to the weak, look at it like this. If someone with a weak conscience sees you, a person with knowledge, sitting down to eat in an idol house, that conscience of theirs is likely to make up its mind to eat idol food, isn't it? And so you see, the weak person, a brother or sister for whom the Messiah has died, is then destroyed by your knowledge. That means you'll be sinning against your brother or sister and attacking their weak conscience, and in doing this, you will have sinned against the Messiah. For this reason, if food causes my brother or sister to stumble, I will never eat meat, so that I won't make my brother or sister trip up. You and I, we've been challenged to deviate from this world. We are to be abnormal. We have received the prescription for holiness, and we've put on Christ Jesus. And now we are called and challenged to live to the Lord. We cannot do it by ourselves. And we sure can't do it in the judgment house. We can only do it in the house of grace and mercy. So I leave you with two big questions today. How clean are your windows? And where do you live?